Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Leaving the White House this morning, President Trump defended new rules his administration is proposing, which would allow for the indefinite detention of migrant children with their parents after illegally crossing the southern border.
Very much I have the children on my mind. It bothers me very greatly. People make this horrible 2,000-mile journey.
And it's been a week of mixed messages from the president, from gun control to cutting taxes to buying Greenland. Last night on Twitter, he abruptly canceled his upcoming visit to Denmark because politicians there snubbed his purchase offer. To discuss all of this, we have with us our political strategist, Yvette Simpson. She's a Democratic strategist and joins us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, glad to be back.
And Matt Mikowiak, he is a Republican strategist. He joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
Well, let's start with immigration. Here's Acting Homeland Security Chief Kevin McAleenan this morning on the new rules allowing for the indefinite detention of migrant children with their parents.
No child should be a pawn in a scheme to manipulate our immigration system, which is why the new rule eliminates the incentive to exploit children as a free ticket, or as one gentleman in Guatemala told me, a passport for migration to the United States.
Yvette, your immediate thoughts on what this means. The Obama administration also tried to get around the rules that restrict how long children could also be held.
You know, this is ridiculous. The trauma that is inflicted upon children in this circumstance, the idea that individuals who are fleeing a lot of times persecution, dangerous situations, harrowing situations in their home countries, that they would use their children to get into this country, that is preposterous. And the idea that we would, as a country, allow children to be separated for any amount of time, let alone indefinitely, from their families is ridiculous. And I just want to add really quickly that the Republicans have not gotten this right yet. The idea that this would be a solution to an already bad problem is ridiculous.
Matt, the acting secretary has said that this change will eliminate this major attraction for families coming across the border. The Trump administration has called it catch and release. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, in my understanding, Yvette may have this mistaken. I don't believe it's about separating them. I believe it's about keeping them together. This essentially replaces the Flores settlement agreement, which was entered into several years ago. And I do believe that the reality of the policy has been that if you brought a child with you, you could be released. It would lead to a quicker release while you're waiting your court date, which may be 9, 12, 15, 18 months out. So you get to live in America, live in the shadows. If you want to show up for your court date, go ahead. If you don't, you don't have to necessarily. And the likelihood that the government will ever find you and would deport you is pretty low. So they're trying to address the incentives at the root level. I agree with Yvette. I'm very worried about the children as well. Would seem to me we should do everything we can not to separate them, but we should also try to prevent these individuals from bringing children with them on the belief that it will make it easier for them to stay in America. You can file for asylum from any U.S. embassy in your home country, in Mexico. You can file at a port of entry. The problem is when you enter illegally and then claim asylum, you've done so by breaking the law initially.
What we've known, though, up to this point is that children are being kept at different facilities than their parents, that the treatment of these children has been traumatizing alone. The idea that when people come to this country, they're coming at a lot of times to reunite with families they already have here. So this policy doesn't talk about whether they're able to actually be with family that they have here in the country. How will they be detained? How will they be kept? Those are all questions that need to be answered.
The real answer to this question is probably getting Congress to pass some sort of comprehensive immigration
reform.
Absolutely. That has not happened. Matt, I want to hear you weigh in on some of the mixed messages that the president has been sending this week. Let's hear from some of his recent statements. Today, he said that the U.S. does not need payroll tax cuts to stimulate the economy, but he's also said this.
I don't see a recession. I mean, the world is in a recession right now.
I've been thinking about payroll taxes for a long time. Whether or not we do it now or not is it's not being done because of recession.
And here he is on the issue of gun control.
I think we can have some really meaningful background checks. We don't want people that are mentally ill, people that are sick. We don't want them having guns. Who does?
A lot of the people that put me where I am are strong believers in the Second Amendment, and I am also. And we have to be very careful about that. You know, they call it the slippery slope.
And then this morning, he returns to supporting some changes for background check laws. Matt, can you sort through this? I am confused. Are you confused?
Yes. And consistent messaging is not always something we see from the White House. This is all occurring while he's on vacation in Bedminster, his club in New Jersey. I imagine he has sort of less staff around him at the moment.
But he's the president of the United States. Is that an excuse?
Well, my point is, I think his time is less structured. He's, you know, has less sort of organization around him. My point is, we see these things happen more often than not when the staff is not around, when he's, you know, in Florida or in New Jersey or something like that. But you're right; they're sending messages on all sides. My guess is that means they don't know what to do. I mean, he wants to do something on gun control, but obviously the bumper sticker things that are thrown out there don't really address the problem, and in many ways would do nothing to prevent future mass shootings. And are much more complicated, particularly the politics of it, than people realize. So,
Yvette, I want you to weigh in, because on these important issues, if Matt is confused, if you are in fact confused, if reporters are confused, what does that mean for the rest of the country who isn't following every single tick of every single day in the president's life? I mean, this could have some damage.
I don't think we're confused. I mean, I think what we know is that in the height of disastrous circumstances in El Paso and Dayton, the president used it as an opportunity to draw attention to himself. He went and did photo ops. He made it sound like he was going to do something. And then reality hit when he had a meeting with the head of the NRA and realized that he was going to lose his support. So there's no mixed message. It is a very clear message that he will say one thing to get attention. And then when the heat is off of him, meaning no one's talking about it, which unfortunately we should still be talking about it, now he's changed his tune and he's thinking about re-election.
Let's talk a little bit about some other statements that Trump made earlier about Jewish people. This morning, Trump doubled down on remarks questioning the loyalty of Jewish voters. He made those remarks when criticizing Muslim Congressman Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, who had been denied entry into Israel. And Omar called for the cutting off of aid to Israel. Here's what Trump said yesterday.
Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these two people over the state of Israel? And I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
Matt, the Republican Jewish Coalition defended the president, but many other Jewish leaders are really, frankly, outraged. What's your first reaction to this?
Yeah, I don't like seeing this through the lens of loyalty or disloyalty. One of the interesting things is I think President Trump has been the most pro-Israel American president in history. I don't even think that it's a close call. And his popularity in Israel is actually higher than it is in America. And you're seeing that with the current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's going through a second national election here in just a couple of weeks, really kind of bear-hugging Trump. So that tells you a little bit about the political dynamic in Israel. So look, I do think if Jewish voters in America care about the U.S.-Israel relationship and care about the policies that Trump has put in place, whether it be moving the embassy, whether it be canceling the Iran deal, backing out of it, other issues, I do think it would make sense that they would want to reward that policy direction by supporting the president. I just think seeing through the lens of loyalty is wrong.
But these statements about being disloyal, I mean, many people are downright offended by it, putting them in that position.
Yeah, and I hope he means loyalty to the Israel and the pro-Jewish cause, not loyalty to himself. It shouldn't be about himself. It should be about the policy.
Yvette, we should also just point out that this is the very thing that Republicans were criticizing Ilhan Omar for when she was making claims that some people were being disloyal. It just seems like it's not totally fair. And have we lost Yvette there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Was that directed to me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay. I just want to back out big picture, to say that the president who has most engendered white nationalism, not only in this country, but around the country, is a gift to Israel is a joke. And I think that American Jews should be afraid of what this president represents and what he's trying to do, right, which is to manipulate American Jews to believe that Democrats don't have their best interest at heart. And the truth, it can't be farther from the truth. You know, his rant today on Twitter, I don't know if we're going to talk about that today, where he likens himself to God and the King of Israel. I mean, it's very, very challenging to be a rational thinker and to provide any rationality to what he's talking about when he sends tweets like that. I think this is another instance where President Trump is trying to see what public interest he has behind him and firm up his base. And I think the idea that rational Jews around the world would be supporting this president, I think, makes no sense to me at all.
Matt, we've got about 45 seconds. I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I mean, I think, look, I don't think the Republican Party has a problem with anti-Semitism. I think the Democratic Party does. And I think you're seeing that through the lens of Congresswoman Tlaib and Congresswoman Omar. The BDS movement is intended to destroy the state of Israel. Boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel is a direct threat to its economy and to its people. So, look, there's a great debate to be had. Both sides can make the argument. We'll see what Jewish voters decide in places like Florida, New York, New Jersey in the upcoming election.
And we'll have to continue it later. Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist, and Yvette Simpson, the Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The night before his first scene with Catherine O'Hara, Dan Levy was a little freaked out.
This is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
The stories behind the celebrities. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
And we want to talk now about swatting. Ever heard of it? It's a dangerous form of harassment where someone places a hoax call to the police telling them there's been something like a murder or an ongoing hostage situation at the target's home. A SWAT team then rushes to the scene, heavily armed and prepared for a dangerous situation. 2 years ago, an unarmed man died during such a raid. We've mentioned swatting before on our program. Police are still grappling with how to handle these kinds of calls. Many of them come in anonymously. But recently, two cases targeting high-profile Black writers caught our attention. Just last week, Ijeoma Alu, a Seattle writer and author of So You Want to Talk About Race, described her experience of being swatted. She received a call from police that there had been reports of gunshots at her home. There wasn't. And Pulitzer Prize-winning Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts Jr. was swatted earlier this summer. He joins us now to talk about it. Leonard, welcome.
Thank you.
So the weekend before July 4th in your home in Maryland, you woke up to a call from the police. If you can, pick up the story from there.
Well, the call came through at 4:48 in the morning. The caller ID identified it as City of Bowie in Maryland, which is where I live. The caller identified himself as the Bowie Police Department and asked if I'd looked outside my window lately. And it's 4:48 in the morning, so of course I haven't looked outside. And he tells me that, quote, half the City of Bowie Police Department is at my front door, and they've received a call that I've murdered my wife and that I need to come downstairs and talk to them, basically. My murdered wife is sitting up, in bed next to me trying to figure out what's going on, and I'm on the phone with at 4:48 in the morning. And I go downstairs, and they have two spotlights, one on my left, one on my right, and I'm effectively blind. And a voice from somewhere out there in the darkness tells me to put down the cell phone, which I do, and to come forward, which I do. And about halfway across, maybe on my neighbor's lawn, they direct me down to my knees, clasped behind on top of your head, and then somebody comes around and handcuffs me. And they take me over to the back behind the police car and explain to me that they've received a call that I've murdered my wife. I didn't find this part out until later, but the caller also told them that I was going to open fire on the police once they responded.
This sounds terrifying. It sounds surreal. And yet you say that you weren't afraid. Why?
It was surreal, and I think, maybe part of it was that, I had just awakened, and I'm still at that threshold where you're trying to separate reality from the dream, how it is when you've awakened abruptly in the middle of the night. But I think the bigger part was that the police themselves were not out of control. They were very calm. And once I saw that and the fact that nobody was yelling at me or cursing at me or threatening me or any of the rest of that stuff, my feeling was that, if we could just go through whatever it was that they needed to go through to assure themselves.
They would see that nobody, your wife was alive.
Yeah. Matter of fact, she came to the door a moment later. They're going to see my wife's alive. They're going to see nothing's happening at the house and everything will be okay. It's just, for me, it was just a matter of let's get to that moment without anything happening.
Right. So all of this happened. Were you surprised by how police handled it, that they reacted in this way?
I was pleasantly surprised because this was a few days after The story had broken about the police in Arizona, I believe it was, maybe Phoenix, essentially brutalizing an African-American family over a shoplifting incident. So to be treated as I was, an assumption of murder, a suspicion of murder. Yeah, I was really surprised that it went as well as it did.
So usually in these cases, the person accused of swatting has individual motives. But we're also learning that there are these crowdsourcing websites where folks there can call on people to do like a mass swat on someone. Why do you think you were targeted?
Oh, I'm pretty sure somebody took exception to something that I wrote in the column. I wouldn't be surprised if whoever swatted me has a MAGA hat somewhere in their closet that they wear very often.
I mentioned that black writer Ijeoma Alu, who lives in Seattle, was targeted specifically, she believes, by white supremacists. She writes about race and white supremacy. And she had actually been in touch with police and talked to them a bit about the fact that she had received information that she might be on some of these swatting websites. There are other folks like Rihanna, Simon Cowell, all types of people who have been swatted. And then also everyday people, like there was just a victim in Iowa this week. What do you think should be done? Who do you think should be held accountable or possibly more safeguards in place to stop this type of thing from happening?
Well, the understanding that I have from the police, and it's really very rudimentary, but that somehow these people are able to route their calls through these internet services, internet providers, and maintain anonymity. And I don't think you should be able to do that, bottom line. I don't think you should be able to call specifically 911 and maintain anonymity through those means. That is ridiculous to me. And then the fact that, in my case, police apparently are having to serve subpoenas to get the information they need, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I would like to see something happen there, whether it's technologically, legally, or both, where people can't just, you know, from some random point on earth, phone in a false call and upend your life.
Mm-hmm. You write about things that many people may not agree with. There are lots of other people who write not only about race, but they may write about gender issues that have also been targeted. And you said that you weren't afraid when this happened, in part because you had woken up in the middle of the night. But what would you say to those who are out there who are on those lists, who are feeling afraid about the work that they're doing and about the potential for this and not being afraid?
I don't know if there's any magic comforting words. This is the cost of doing business, in, particularly in the world that we're in today. I will tell you this much. Back in 2007, when I had an issue with death threats, a bunch of neo-Nazis, I was given an award by the NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists. I kind of jokingly call it an award for not getting killed. But the thing that I said in the acceptance speech was that, you know, for a while, this was the worst thing that had happened to me. This was a terrible, you know, difficult moment in my life. But then I thought about it, and Medgar Evers would have called it Tuesday. You know, Martin Luther King would have called it Tuesday. And when you really stop and think and look at what others who have come before you have gone through, and they never faltered, and they never buckled, and they did what had to be done, it kind of puts into perspective what you're dealing with, you know, some random idiots making phone calls and doing things of that nature. I mean, you know, Medgar Evers would be grateful. I would have been grateful if for my quote-unquote problem.
Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts, Jr., thank you so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
And now to Texas, where more than 20 cities and towns are the latest targets of ransomware attacks. Officials from two of the affected cities, Keene and Borger, have spoken out about the attacks. A spokesperson for the Texas Department of Information Resources says there's evidence of one single threat actor. Joining us now by Skype is Eddie Block, former Texas State Chief Information Security Officer. And Eddie, this sounds debilitating for those small towns that don't have sophisticated cyber infrastructure. Can you tell us why we don't know more about which cities and towns since last Friday have been affected?
It's a trade-off, really. I mean, there's a transparency argument to be made, but while cities and towns are still trying to recover, there's the potential of highlighting to other attackers that they may be less resourced than normal, as they have people that have been working to address the current situation.
What's the first thing some of these municipalities do? What can they do right after a ransomware attack? Is it smart to pay the actors what they're demanding?
it's typically not the best approach to pay the attackers. The FBI has clearly come out against paying ransomware. One thing to keep in mind is that there is no guarantee that you will get your data back after you pay the ransom. The other part is it could potentially put you on a list of victims who are willing to pay, making you, again, a target for the next round of attacks.
Mm-hmm. The mayor of one of the affected cities, Keene, told NPR that the hackers attacked software by an outsourced company, which is also used by other municipalities. Is this a tactic, you think, that these hackers are using to hit as many targets as possible?
Once you're able to find a vulnerability in a software package that may not be as well maintained or has a public vulnerability, that gives the attacker that initial point of entry that then they can use for whatever they need.
Yeah, I'm guessing bottom line, this affects city services. How is this going to affect residents in those cities?
Potentially. I mean, I think we saw in Baltimore where there was a significant impact to the citizens' abilities to pay for municipal services. The real question is the scale of the recovery and how long it takes to come back online.
I mentioned the Texas Department of Information Resources says that there's evidence that this is one single threat actor. Do you have any idea of what type of entity would have a motive to do something like this?
It really comes down to organized crime or a nation state actor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Baltimore. There are also other cities across the country that have been attacked by ransomware. What do you suggest municipalities do to prevent this from happening?
So the first thing is ensuring that you've got a quality incident response plan and that plan involves a systematic backup and recovery process that's been tested. A lot of folks will write an incident response plan and then never test it. Mm. So when you look at a small town that outsourced to a vendor, ensuring that that vendor is capable of managing a response like this is really critical.
Mm. That's Eddie Block, an associate at Foley and Lartner, who served as the Texas State Chief Information Security Officer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the thoughtful question.
Amtrak appears to be on the verge of a turnaround. Later this fall, the passenger rail service is likely to break even for the first time since it was founded in 1971. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's Here and Now, a transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Peter.
And what's happening at Amtrak?
Yeah, as you said, on the verge of breaking even, on its way to perhaps generating a profit.
A modest statement, by the way, on the verge of breaking even.
Exactly. And to be clear, this would be an operating profit. So once all the infrastructure is in place, all those capital costs, then being to at least turn a profit, perhaps at least break even with the operation itself, the collecting all the fares, having that add up to the cost of running the railroad. But to be clear, it's not as though all the routes are just sort of more or less muddling along. If you dig a little deeper in that break-even result, more or less, you have the Northeast Corridor routes, so New York to Boston, New York to Washington, yeah, those kinds of things, generating about $500 million a year profit, but then other routes losing about that much money. There are other bright spots, some other short-haul routes like Chicago-Milwaukee, for example, that do rather well. So some routes doing incredibly well, others doing very poorly.
Well, and it sounds like the relatively new CEO, Richard Anderson, formerly of Delta, wants to replicate some of that success that you're talking about in the Northeast Corridor by trying to develop new routes, short-distance treks between cities like Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Tell us about that and how difficult that would be to pull off.
Yeah, that's where rail tends to work. Cities that are a few hundred miles apart. If you look over in Europe, let's say, a lot of those kinds of city pairs. Now, there are other important differences, too. So if you say, well, what about that? What about, Kansas City, St. Louis, which is already served, Chicago, St. Louis, which is already served, places like that. So you have the speed of the trains, which just isn't where it would have to be. You'd have to take those 5 or 6 hour trips, get them down to more like 3 hours, let's say. The other big question, Peter, is whether the cities themselves are designed in a place where it can thrive. When you think of New York to Washington, New York to Boston, you have people on both ends who live very close to a railway station, where even if the train itself takes a little longer than a flight, door-to-door, especially with no TSA, can be very attractive. Harder to say whether, you know, Houston to Dallas, other more sprawling metropolises would support something like that. There's a private railroad down in South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, that were so far ridership expectations aren't quite measuring up to what they hoped.
Short-term, Amtrak has announced that customers who are traveling as a part of a group, groups of six or more traveling on the same itinerary, will get a 45% discount on their fare. Now, that does not sound like a company that is doing good. Exactly. That sounds like a company who's eagerly seeking new customers.
Yeah, but if you look a little more closely, this actually does replicate something that, well, let's turn back to Europe. What happens is when you have people traveling together, that's when piling into a car becomes more attractive. So in some markets, yeah, Amtrak competes against airlines, but in a lot of cases, it competes against driving. And so for one person traveling alone, the train fare plus the convenience of not having to drive might be attractive. Mm-hmm. But once you get those 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people traveling together, that's where, you know, those fixed costs of driving doesn't cost more to really to run a car with all those people.
Seth
tends
Kaplan,
to make more sense.
Here and Now transportation analyst. Thank you.
Are you lonely? There could soon be a pill for that. Researchers at the University of Chicago Bryan Dynamics Lab may be on the verge of developing a drug to combat chronic loneliness and social isolation. There's a practical reason to solve loneliness. The health ramifications are real. Loneliness has been shown to weaken a person's immune system. Those in their 20s, 50s, and 80s are most susceptible to loneliness. According to a study by the University of California, San Diego Medical School, those times in life where people are going through big transitions, like going away to college or the decline in friends and family as you grow older, we wanted to learn more about loneliness and how a pill could help solve it. To break this all down, we have with us Julian Holt Lundstad. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University in Utah. Professor Holt Lundstad, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so this lonely pill, as it's called, it's made up of a naturally occurring hormone produced in the adrenal gland. And researchers behind the lonely pill say that their goal is to not only stop loneliness, but to regulate the way it affects the mind and the body. I'd like to know from you, what are your thoughts on this idea? Do you feel like loneliness requires a medical intervention like this?
Well, I think like most people, when I very first heard about it, there was a little bit of skepticism because I think we don't necessarily associate our relationships with something that a pill could fix. But yet perceptions of loneliness are something that may be related to biological signals.
Oh, explain what you mean by that.
Yeah. So most scientists agree that humans are social species. Much like other animals, it's more adaptive to be in groups and adapted to survival, that similarly humans are social species. In fact, the late John Cacioppo argued that loneliness is much like hunger or thirst, whereas hunger and thirst are biological motives that motivate us to seek out food or water, that loneliness motivates us to reconnect socially. And so in that sense, loneliness is something that is adaptive and something that we actually wouldn't really want to get rid of because it helps us to reconnect.
Okay.
The problem, however, is when we experience loneliness chronically. And that's where I think many of the negative health effects can occur and where we need to really focus our intervention efforts.
Ah, okay. So I see what you're saying. You're saying that loneliness, like hunger, can be a signal. Okay, you're hungry, you know to go eat. If you're lonely, you know to be in a social situation so you can quell that loneliness. But in some people, they may be chronically lonely and not going out to get that stimuli from other folks. And so
this pill might offer a solution for them to be able to step outside of themselves and do that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And so in some cases, providing more opportunities for those social connections may be the best option. Mm-hmm. But for others, despite being around others, may still feel profoundly lonely. Mm-hmm. And so if we think of loneliness as almost like a social barometer, in some instances, that may be off. It may need to be recalibrated. And in those instances, perhaps a solution such as the one they are suggesting may be appropriate. But in other circumstances, other kinds of approaches may be more appropriate.
I guess this goes back to what you were saying about all of us at some point feel that it's a natural thing that happens. But this chronic loneliness, do you feel like we're seeing more of this in society, and what might be the reasons for that?
Well, it's difficult to know whether it's actually increasing or if we're simply more aware of it. But there is some evidence also to suggest that perhaps people are becoming more disconnected. Now, if we think about loneliness specifically, that is perhaps less routinely collected on a national level. So it's hard to know whether it's actually increasing or not. But we do have evidence that in terms of demographic trends, that we have more people living alone than ever before. Fewer people are getting married. Fewer people are having children. So there is some evidence to suggest that people are becoming more socially disconnected. And the big question, I guess, is why? Mm-hmm. Why might this be? But I also think that there's some more recent trends that may also be influencing why we're more concerned about this. Regardless of whether trends are on the rise or remaining stable, that there's reason to be concerned. I think that there's a lot of concern around the role of technology. Of course, this is a very hotly debated topic, but nonetheless, it's clear that the way in which we are interacting socially has changed with changing types of technology. And I think there's a growing concern around, is this change for the good or for worse? Mm-hmm. There's also, I think, a growing sense of a fraying social fabric. There's growing acrimony and the growing polarization in terms of politics and the way in which people engage civically. And we see a lot of disharmony in society. And there's also a growing sense of a need for success, such that people are working longer hours. Kids have enormous pressure to succeed in school, to be involved in a number of extracurricular activities, such that work and other kinds of efforts that are aimed at increasing success are really pushing out the time that might otherwise be spent with friends and family. Mm. And so I don't think it's just one thing. I think there's many others that I haven't even mentioned. But I think that there is certainly a growing concern.
Which really brings us to what my last question is for you. And that's that some argue that this type of treatment is just a pharmacological buffer against something that is a human woe that we can actually fix by taking on some of those issues that you're talking about. I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things we need to be really mindful of is that people can become lonely or disconnected from a variety of different circumstances. For some, it may be a mobility issue. Among older adults, that there's an increasing risk for hearing loss. For others, it may be a role loss. And we need to aim our solutions to address the underlying cause. And if there's a mismatch between what people actually need and what they're receiving, we're unlikely to find a solution. It may be unsuccessful. And so I think we need to recognize that there's not going to be one magic bullet one magic pill that's going to fix it all. And while there may be a place for a pharmaceutical intervention in cases where some of these other approaches have been unsuccessful, we also need to exercise caution in that there needs to be growing education and training in the medical field in how to deal with the growing, what, or at least what some are referring to as an epidemic of loneliness. Mm-hmm. And if all physicians have in their toolbox is a prescription, that may be the only solution that patients are offered, and that we really need to, in essence, put more tools in that toolbox so that we can use the right tool for the right issue to make sure that we have the best solutions.
Julian Holt Lundstad, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University in Utah. Professor Holt Lundstad, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And researchers at the University of Chicago's Brian Dynamics Lab finished their final studies in June. No word on when this loneliness pill will be available to the public.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is asking European leaders to do something they've already rejected. He wants to renegotiate Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. Johnson is in Germany today for meetings with Chancellor Angela Merkel, and he'll be in Paris tomorrow to speak with the French president. Deal or no deal, he's promised to take the UK out of the EU on October 31st. The BBC's Damian McGuinness joins us now from Berlin. Damian, it's good to speak with you.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be here.
And the British Prime Minister has been quite clear. There is no deal if the so-called Irish backstop remains. By the way, that has always been a sticking point in Brexit negotiations with Europe. Explain more what the Prime Minister is thinking here.
Well, that's the big question, really, because a lot of people are unsure where he's going with this negotiating tactic. This backstop, as a reminder, is an insurance policy, essentially, that there is no hard border in the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland after Brexit. Ordinarily, after Brexit, you're going to have two different tariff regimes. You might have two different regimes of regulation. So the backstop is very controversial in Britain, a very controversial measure, which would mean that the UK and Northern Ireland would be tightly aligned and for a certain amount of time, potentially within the customs union, the single market. Now, this is something that Boris Johnson objects to. The reason why this is a strange thing to be fixated on, though, is that it's clear that the EU will not back down on this. Mm-hmm. The EU sees this as the only viable option. And so far, Mr. Johnson and the British government has not really come up with an alternative solution. So Angela Merkel said she's open to other ideas, she's open to other solutions. But until those other solutions are there, the backstop has to remain, this insurance policy, essentially. So the question is, why is Mr. Johnson pushing this when he knows that the EU and Mrs. Merkel will not change their mind, because they see this as solidarity with Ireland, an EU member, and also as a way of keeping the single market together?
Does it seem like he honestly is trying to change people's minds, or is he just going through the motions, checking off a box before he bails out without a deal?
If you look at the German press and a lot of the opinions here in Germany, within the government and within commentators, most people are of the opinion that Mr. Johnson is pursuing a tactic to appeal to domestic voters back in Britain. Mm. And that what this is about staging a sort of negotiation, making demands that Germany and the EU will never agree to. And then if and when there is a no-deal Brexit and there are economic problems created by that, Mr. Johnson, the British government, would point to the role of Germany and to the role of the EU and say it's the EU's fault. Mm. So that's the view in Berlin right now. That's what people assume. Now, whether that's true or not is another matter, but the fact that that is what people here widely believe indicates the lack of trust in Germany towards Boris Johnson.
And how is Germany feeling about the prospect of the UK crashing out without a deal, considering the state of the German economy right now?
Well, it would be a problem for Germany, certainly, because British exports are an important part of German business. And there are other risks on the horizon right now which could potentially impact the German economy. But really, what German businesses have said all along is that given the various risks they have to deal with, the most important thing for them is the EU. It's the EU markets, 26 other EU markets apart from Britain, and it's the single market, which is the mechanism that keeps borders open for trade between Germany and other EU countries. So what Mr. Johnson is asking Germany to do and the EU to do, in the eyes of German business, would undermine and dilute and endanger the single market. So German business tends to think very politically and thinks long term. And so the risk assessment that most German business leaders we've spoken to over the past few years is that the lesser of two evils would be a no-deal Brexit or to lose some British business than to endanger the whole single market. So that's what we've heard all along within Germany. And that is still the view from business today, that given the choice, they'd rather take a hit and lose some British business than endanger the single market, which is so essential for the German economy in general.
Now, Boris Johnson is going to move on from Germany tomorrow. He will be in Paris with the French President Emmanuel Macron. Will things be different there or similar theme as what we saw in Berlin?
I think what we found over the past couple of years since the referendum vote is this incredible unity within the EU. And that surprised even the EU itself. So that's something that no political leader is right now going to jeopardize. Now, there are differences of opinion between the French and German leaders. Traditionally, Germany is more open and more pragmatic when it comes to dealing with Britain. And Angela Merkel is very much a leader who will enable other leaders to save face if it has a pragmatic solution. Traditionally, Emmanuel Macron has taken a harder line with Britain and has said some quite tough things about how it's more important to stick to the EU rules than to cater to what Britain wants. But at the end of the day, when it comes to concrete issues of whether, for example, we keep the backstop or whether we reopen the exit agreement, there's no difference of opinion between France and Germany. And what we've seen over the past few years, there's no reason to believe that's going to be undermined or endangered anytime soon.
Well, the UK may have a new prime minister, but nothing is getting easier over these Brexit negotiations. Damian McGuinness in Berlin, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.